So Arjuna is looking for some relief. And as Krishna delivered the earth from the ocean, so he should deliver Arjuna from this ocean of misery. And as Govinda protects cows, so he should now protect Arjuna from this, his lamentation. So now text 10. This text is called Rasa Sandhi, because the relationship changes between Krishna and Arjuna. Sandhi means the conjunction or junction. Sandhi, like sandhya. It's a junction or a conjunction of the day and night is the sandhya. So this is the Rasa Sandhi.
Tamuvacha Rishikesha Prahasan Iva Bharata Senayor Ubhayor Madhye Pashidantam Idam Vachaha.
O descendant of Bharat, at that time Krishna, smiling in the midst of both the armies, spoke the following words to the grief-stricken Arjuna. So, here, again, we have the name Rishikesh. Another meaning. So Vishwanath Chakravarti says, although Krishna was previously controlled by the loving statements of Arjuna, now, for Arjuna's own welfare, Krishna is controlling his mind. Krishna is controlling his own mind out of love for Arjuna. Because before, Krishna was controlled by Arjuna's loving statements. But now Krishna is not allowing Arjuna's friendly behavior to conquer his mind. So Krishna is controlling his own mind in order to take the role of the guru out of love for Arjuna. So he's not just joking with Arjuna anymore, but he's controlling himself. And Prabhupada mentions that in his commentary. We see the word prahasan, which means smiling. And that smile of Krishna gradually waned to where Krishna was pursing his lips or controlling his smile, like making a kind of grimace, looking at Arjuna more seriously. So that smile was changing. Prabhupada comments, it appears that the talk between the master and the disciple was openly... The talk was going on between intimate friends, namely Rishikesh and Gudakesh. As friends, both of them were on the same level, but one of them voluntarily became a student of the other. Krishna was smiling because a friend had chosen to become a disciple. As Lord of all, he is always in a superior position as the master of everyone. And yet, the Lord agrees to be a friend, son, or lover for a devotee who wants him in such a role. But when he was accepted as the master, he at once assumed the role and talked with the disciple like the master, with gravity, as it is required. Also, Senayor Ubhayor Madhye indicates that though they were in between the two armies, and there were no secrets now, that it was open to all. Krishna's instruction and Arjuna's grief was visible to both sides. And Prabhupada mentions that the talk between master and disciple was openly exchanged in the presence of both armies, so that all were benefited. Right. So that statement comes from Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakura, and Prabhupada just wrote it in a different way, slightly different way. So now Krishna takes the role of the guru. He's no longer just Arjuna's friend. And he begins his preaching. His first lecture to Arjuna, and the first philosophical treatise in Bhagavad Gita, the beginning of the philosophy, with text 11. And as I said, Arjuna's first reason was compassion for his relatives. So now Krishna will confront that objection and defeat it in this section, which goes up to text 30. Where Krishna concludes the whole section by saying, Tasmat sarvani bhutani natvam shochitum arhasi. Therefore, he who dwells in the body can never be slain. Therefore, you need not grieve for any living being, even Bhishma. Right? That is the meaning. So as we said, Krishna tells Arjuna what he's going to tell him, then he tells him, then he concludes and tells him what he told him in this section. And it's a mark of an intelligent preacher or a writer. There's a beginning, a middle, and an end. So Krishna begins. Shri Bhagavan Vacha Ashochan Anvasochastvam Pragya Vadamscha Bhashase Gatasun Gatasunscha Nanu Shochante Pandidaha. The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, while speaking learned words, you are mourning for what is not worthy of grief. Those who are wise lament neither for the living nor for the dead. So immediately the guru chastises the disciple, like giving a little verbal slap to Arjuna, calling him indirectly a fool, because he's lamenting for something which is not lamentable. And he says, although pragyavarams, Jambhasha say, although speaking like a learned person, actually a real pandit, a real learned person, nanu shochanti, they don't become full of lamentation in such a circumstance. Gatasum, agatasumscha, whether the prana of the body has left or whether it is not left. He sees that this is not cause for any shochan, for lamentation. So although speaking very learned words, like a pandit, for factually learned persons, they do not grieve like you're grieving, Arjuna. So therefore you are a fool. And here Krishna is telling Arjuna that before you told that Dharma Shastra is higher than Artha Shastra, Arjuna, but now I'm telling you that Jnana Shastra is even higher than Dharma Shastra. So please hear. So Krishna is referring to the spirit soul. Because only by understanding Atma Tattva can Arjuna transcend the lamentation and false compassion for these bodily relatives. If he understands that they're eternal, that they can never be killed, that they're going to get a new body which will be refreshing for them, and there's no reason to lament. So Krishna immediately sets the stage for speaking the next few verses by just stating that the living or the dead, the state of living or dead, is not a basis for a lamentation for a learned person, for a pundit. And it means that Bhishma is also an Atma, or a spirit soul, who has gross and subtle bodies which are covering him, his Atma. So since the Atma is eternal, and Bhishma is also an Atma, soul, so it's improper to lament for the soul, because it's eternal. It can never be killed. That's the whole gist of this section. So now, 11 is like a prelude leading up to the next verse, 10, where he describes more about the individual soul. Natrivaham jatu nasam natvam neme janadipaha nachayeva na bhavishyama sarvevayam nataparam. Never was there a time when I did not exist, nor you, nor all of these kings, nor in the future shall any of us cease to be. So, natrivaham jatu nasam. So, there was never a time when I did not exist. I am Krishna now. I am Krishna. I was Krishna before. I am Krishna now, and I will be Krishna in the future. You were Arjuna before. You are Arjuna now, and you will be Arjuna in the future. And all of these kings also, they have their individualities. They existed before. They're here now, and they will exist in the future. Even Bhishma. So there's no reason to lament. We're all eternal. So he's stressing the eternality of the soul, but he's also stressing the individuality, because he's saying I, aham, tram, you, and Janadipa, and all of the kings. He doesn't say that before the kings and you were a part of me, we were all one, and now we've separated, and in the future you will all merge back into me again. No, he says in the future they will cease to exist, or they will continue to exist as individuals. The kings, you, and me. All of us. So, Prabhupada mentions that the Mayavadi theory that after liberation the individual soul separated by the covering of Maya will merge into the impersonal Brahman and lose its individual existence is not supported here by Lord Krishna, the Supreme Authority. Nor is it the theory that we only think of individuality in the conditioned state supported herein. Individuality continues. Krishna clearly says herein that in the future also the individuality of the Lord and others, as it is confirmed in the Upanishads, will continue eternally. And he quotes, Nitya Nityanam Chaitanas Chaitananam Eko Bahonam Yova Dadhati Kaman Tam Atmastam Ye Nupashanti Dhiras Tesham Shanti Shashvati Ne Turesham from Katri Upanishad. So the difference between the body and the soul has already been stressed. Now, again, eternality and the individuality is again stressed. Krishna is saying that, my dear friend Arjuna, when one grieves over the death of a dear one, what is the object of his love, the body or the soul? And Prabhupada has used this example many times, and it's a potent one, because if you've ever experienced the death of a dear one, then you know that the body's there, but still you cannot feel that the person's there because something's missing. And even the most simple person can understand that example, especially if they've had this experience. I remember when I was a young boy, my mother passed away. I was about 16. And in the West, they have a wake where they place the body in a coffin and they put some makeup and, you know, dress the hair and like this, and then there's like a last darshan and you come before the body and you offer some prayers like this. And when I came to the coffin and I looked and I said, that's my mother? She's completely different, because they made her look like, it almost looked like it wasn't her, it was not even her body. So not only did I feel that she had gone, I also felt that this is definitely not her also. You know, there was a complete detachment. So what is the actual dear thing to the person? It's not the body. Because if it was the body, then you would feel satisfied. You wouldn't be crying when the dear one leaves. But because it's the soul which is dear, therefore we lament. In the Bhagavatam it's mentioned, Sarvaisham apibhutanam nirpa svatmayava vallabha, that the own soul, that is the most dear thing to one. And then the soul of another person. the deer one. That is the deer thing. So Krishna is stressing this because Arjuna is focused on the body of his relatives and his gurus, not on the Atma. So this whole section, he's focusing Arjuna's attention on the Atma, so that Arjuna will gradually, by focusing his mind on the Atma, rise above his grief. And because this verse very clearly defeats Mayavad philosophy, so Prabhupada spends a lot of time speaking about it in his commentary. As all acharyas do, Vaishnava acharyas, he's defeating the Mayavad doctrine. In the last part of the commentary, he says that the Mayavadis argue that the plurality mentioned in this verse is conventionally refers to the body. But how could that be? Because Krishna has already condemned the bodily conception in the previous verse. And in the previous two verses, beginning from 11. So now, why would he, or how could he, again, place a conventional understanding on the individuality, which is being discussed in this verse, or a conventional proposition on the body, saying that the individuality is only referring to the body? That's what the Mayavadis say. So that doesn't make sense if you look at the context of this statement. So, and Krishna goes further to drive home the point even more in the next verse. Dehino smin yatha dehe komaram yovanam jara tatha dehantara prakti dhiras tatra namuyati. As the embodied soul continually passes in this body from boyhood to youth to old age, the soul similarly passes into another body at death. A sober person is not bewildered by such a change. Prabhupada comments, there was no cause for lamentation by Arjuna on account of death, neither for Bhishma nor for Drona, for whom he was so much concerned. Rather, he should rejoice for their changing bodies from old to new ones, thus thereby rejuvenating their energy. So Bhishma and Drona, being noble souls, were sure to go to have spiritual bodies in the next life, or at least life in heavenly bodies, for superior enjoyment of material existence. So in either case, there was no cause for lamentation. So Krishna's logic is that, okay, the body's changing from child to youth to old age, and the soul doesn't change. The soul passes into another body at death, and the person who's intelligent, he is not bewildered by that change. So someone doesn't lament when they lose their childhood and become a youth, right? Now, someone may lament when they lose their youth and become an old man, right? But if an old man is going to take birth again and become again a child, then he shouldn't lament because he's going to get rejuvenated. He'll get a new body. So Bhishma and Drona are old, and according to the logic here, he'll get another body, a young body, and then there's no reason to lament. And probably that body will be in Swarga or even a spiritual body, because they're great souls. So there's certainly no reason to lament for them. Just like Yayati, he was old, right? Because he was lusty and he fell in love with Devayani when he picked her out of the well, because her maidservant Sarmishta had a fight with her over the sari, and then she dumped her, you know, picked her up and threw her in the well. Right. So when Yayati came by on his valiant steed, he heard this woman shouting or screaming, "Help! and looked there on the well and picked her out of the well, and she was all, her clothes were all wet, so clinging to her body he could see her beautiful figure, and he immediately fell in love with her. So then he asked her, please marry me. And so then she went to Shukracharya, and Shukracharya agreed for this Pratiloma marriage. It's not usual, because the Kshatriya marries his Kshatriya or a lady from a lower caste. But Shukracharya, knowing very well about Sarmishta and Devayani and how they're always fighting, then he said to the king that you can have my wife, my daughter for your wife, but and you will have all of her maidservants, but you must never have union with Sarmishta, because they have this envy towards each other and she'll never be peaceful. And so he agreed. So then later he began having children with Devayani and the other maidservants, of which there were many. And naturally Sarmishta felt neglected, and her time for bearing children came to pass, and she approached the king once, twice, three times. You know, he said, no, I promise not to. And then she approached again and again, and she was adamant. So after some time, he agreed, had union with her, and had children. And she was living separate from the palace in a little hermitage near the palace with two boys. In Mahabharata, it describes some more details about the Leela. And then once... Devayani was strolling through the grounds near the palace, and she saw that Sarmishta was there, and she had these two boys, and she said, where did you get those two boys from? Huh? and she said, well, tell me immediately. You didn't have union with my husband? No, of course not. Well, where did you get the two children from? Well, some rishi was wandering past and came here, and I made friends with him. Oh, really? Are you sure? Yes. All right then. And Devayani was satisfied. She walked away. And then later, Yayati and Devayani were strolling the grounds together. And then the two boys ran up to Yayati. Pita, pita! They grabbed his leg. You know, they grabbed his legs and they were cuddling him, and he was... And then Devayani looked. And she immediately left and went to Shukracharya. He's a rascal. He broke the promise. What? Shukracharya cursed him. You know, and he lost... He became old. Immediately he was like, you know, 85, 90 years old. And then he came there decrepit in his old age, begging Shukracharya, please, anything but this. No, can't be. I said, why should I withdraw my curse from you, you rascal? You didn't fulfill your promise to me. But he had some good reason. Said, yes, but your daughter is young, and she also has so many desires. How will she fulfill her desires if I'm an old man? And he thought, you got a good point there. Didn't think of that. All right, if you can find someone who can change, who's willing to change their youth for your old age, then you can switch. I'll give you that option. Okay, so then he went to ask his five sons. And the first son, Yadu, eldest son, he asked him and said, no, I cannot do this. I want to do my Krishna bhajan. How will I perform my sadhana? You know? So I have to perform my religious duties. And if I'm old, then I won't be able to do them. And then my whole life is wasted. So please, my dear father, excuse me. Like this. Well, he had a good reason. He denied, but still, his reason was pure. So therefore, Yadu is glorified. And therefore, Krishna took birth in his dynasty. The other three sons just said, nah, we don't want your old age. We want to enjoy. And like this, they just rejected their father wholesale without any religious reasons and with a very proud attitude. So those persons were not religious. And then finally he approached Puru, the youngest son, and he agreed. So Puru sacrificed his youth and Yayati became young. And he was old and he became young. It's a cause for rejoicing, not for lamentation. And so Yayati actually enjoyed with Devayani for 1,000 years, enjoying romance and conjugal pastimes together. And then after 1,000 years, finally he came to his son and he said, now it's time for me to give back your youth. So then Puru was there and said, as you like. And Yayati said that, but I must tell you that I'm very disappointed, that it's amazing that even though I've been enjoying with this beautiful lady conjugal affection for 1,000 years, still I am not satisfied. But now I have to give back my youth because of my promise to you. But he told Puru, he said, the senses and sense gratification can never satisfy the soul. And it's just like pouring ghee on the fire. The fire just gets bigger and bigger. That fire doesn't go out. So this verse is in the Bhagavatam, but it's also by Yayati, he's speaking in Mahabharata, the same analogy he gives. He says, enjoying the senses is just like pouring ghee on fire, and it doesn't satisfy me. But even though I've endeavored so much to enjoy myself, still I'm unsatisfied. That is the nature of sense gratification. But anyway, Yayati was old and became young. And so that was a cause for jubilation for him. At least he thought so at the time. So Bhishma and Drona are also spirit souls, and they'll get a new body. Prabhupada comments, the individual fragmental spirit soul is represented by Arjuna, and the supreme soul is the personality of Godhead Shri Krishna. They are not on the same level, as will be apparent in the beginning of the fourth chapter. If Arjuna is on the same level with Krishna, and Krishna is not superior to Arjuna, then their relationship of instructor-instructed becomes meaningless. If both of them are deluded by the illusory energy, then there is no need of one being the instructor and the other the instructed. So again, Prabhupada is defeating Mayavad philosophy, that the individual soul is equal to the supreme soul. But rather, Krishna is the supreme soul and he's not affected by Maya. And he's not in illusion like Arjuna is in this Kurukshetra drama. Because otherwise, what is the purpose of people studying Bhagavad Gita and commenting on it if Krishna is on the same level as Arjuna? And they're both in Maya. There's no need for Krishna to instruct Arjuna. So, Krishna continues. Because Arjuna is, he begins to accept, I accept that Bhishma will get a new body. He's not the body. He's a spirit soul. He's eternal. He'll probably be elevated. But still, I'm attached to my relationship with him the way it is now. I can't bear in my mind thinking that he will die. And then what to speak that I will be the instrument of his death. This is causing me grief still. Even if I accept that he's not the body. Still, I want him to remain as he is. I have a relationship with his body from before. I was his grandson. I was sitting on his very lap of his body. He was stroking me with his hand and blessing me. So my relationship is with his body. So how can I just forget all about that? My mind is suffering in this way. I'm attached to this relationship. One second. So now Krishna speaks the next verse, telling Arjuna, but basically, you just have to tolerate this. That is, there's nothing you can do. Because the temporary appearance of happiness and distress, and it's just like summer and winter coming and going. And it just comes from sense perception. Matra sparshastakam. And shitoshna shubhadukada agama payanon. It's tongues to tikshas. Well, you have to tolerate this. So this is actually Krishna's first directive, you could say, for Arjuna. A spiritual instruction, a sadhana, or an approach to spiritual life. He told him that the body and soul are different and that the soul is eternal and there's individuality. But now Arjuna still has a problem. So Krishna says you have to tolerate. And he says that a person in the royal order should be even more tolerant than a common man towards the dualities of life. Heat and cold, honor and dishonor, happiness and distress. That's life. It comes and goes. Riding high in April, shut down in May. You know, this is the way life is. And there's nothing you can do. It's material life, Arjuna. You have to learn how to tolerate this without being disturbed. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur mentions in his commentary that a person still must take bath in the month of Magh. And Prabhupada writes in his commentary the same point. This is a Vedic injunction. Even though it's cold, in February or January, still one has to take a morning bath. He can't skip his bath. Because the elevated person has to perform his puja, or at least his Gayatri and Japa, and he can't do that unless he's clean. And anyway, Arjuna, you're from the royal order. You're a Kshatriya, worthy of becoming emperor. So surely you must be tolerant, more than the common man. And Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur comments that Krishna tells Arjuna, you cannot give up your Swadharma fighting in the battle on the plea of affection for relatives. It's definitely a cause of great disturbance to give up one's Swadharma, which is given in Shastra. You can't just say that, well, because I have affection for my relatives, now I'm going to give up my Swadharma. Swadharma is very important. It's not such an insignificant thing that you can pass it off so easily. Prabhupada comments also that the two different names of address given to Arjuna are also significant in this verse. To address him as Kauntea signifies his great blood relations from his mother's side, and to address him as Bharat signifies his greatness from his father's side. From both sides, he is supposed to have a great heritage. A great heritage brings responsibility in the matter of proper discharge of duties. Therefore, he cannot avoid fighting. He's caught from both sides. He's cornered. So he's called Kauntea and Bharat in this verse because it indicates his great duty as a person of high lineage, that he has to tolerate the pain that he's going to feel when he has to fight against Bhishma and Drona and all of his relatives.
Yam hi na vatayantyete purusham purusharshabha samadhuka sukham dhiram somrityatyaiva kalpate.
O best among men, Arjun, the person who is not disturbed by happiness and distress is steady in both, is certainly eligible for liberation. So purusharshabha, the best of all persons, they're unaffected by the dualities of life. And they do their duty even in the midst of great calamities and distress. And therefore, such people become eligible for moksha, or liberation. Amritatrayava kalpate.
So this is the result when someone is able to tolerate and become peaceful and undisturbed in happiness and distress. This is the adhikar for someone to achieve liberation.
Prabhupada quotes Lord Chaitanya took sannyas at the age of 24. So he tolerated the fact that he had a beautiful young wife, Vishnupriya, and a very loving mother, Sachidevi. But because of the higher cause, he took sannyas in the discharge of his duties.
He mentions also, anyone who is steady in his determination for the advanced stage of spiritual realization and can equally tolerate the onslaughts of distress and happiness is certainly a person eligible for liberation. In the Varnashram institution, the fourth stage, sannyas, is a painstaking situation. But one who is serious about making his life perfect surely adopts the sannyas order of life in spite of all difficulties.
So, text 16. Na sato vidyate bhavo, na bhavo vidyate sataha, ubayor api drishtam tas tvanayos tatvadhashibhi. Those who are seers of the truth have concluded that of the non-existent, the material body, there is no endurance, and of the eternal, the soul, there is no change. This they have concluded by studying the nature of both. In other words, Krishna is saying that Bhishma and you are both eternal. Then why are you thinking that either of you will be destroyed? This is the defect in your knowledge, Arjuna. Krishna tells Arjuna.
Text 17. Avinashi tutadvidhi yena sarvam idam tatam vinasham avayasyasya na kaschit kartam arhati.
That which pervades the entire body, you should know to be indestructible. No one is able to destroy that imperishable soul.
The soul is eternal, cannot be destroyed.
Prabhupada describes how the soul is the size of 1/10,000th the tip of the hair, quoting from the various shastras. Keshagra shatabhagasha shatangsha shadrashatmaka jiva shukshma sarupa yam sakyantito hi chitkana. Is sankhyatito. The soul is above being counted. It's immeasurable. Cannot measure the soul. And it's very small. It's shukshma, very subtle. And actually, these statements in the Shastra are just to give the idea. Because even you cannot say that the soul is 1/10,000th the tip of the hair. Even that is a measurement. Because actually it is asankito. It's transcendental to being counted. Asankhyatito. It's transcendental to measuring. Jiva Goswami mentions in his Sandarbhas this point. Actually.
Just to give some idea how small it is, it's kind of an inconceivable small unit. You know? It's so small that, I mean, you can't even see the tip of a hair, and then if you divide that into 10,000ths, then it's, you know, you definitely can't see it. So you cannot see the soul with an atomic or electronic microscope. But even the small particles of the atom that the scientists know of, like protons, neutrons, electrons, they can't actually see them with the electronic microscope. But they can only see the way they behave and how they cause other particles to move. See, so only by anuman, or inference, they establish these particles. So they can't actually see them with the eye. And what to speak of the soul, which is even smaller than the electron, or the proton, or the neutron. So they can't really see these, they can't see the atom either. It's too small. And the soul is inside of the atom. Actually, it's very small. In every atom, Paramanu, Chantaran. What is that verse? Paramanu, Andataran, Paramanu, Chantarastam. Yeah, Chayantarastam. He's inside. So why would the Govinda be inside of the atom? The super soul, at least, in the form of the super soul. The super soul's function is to accompany the individual jiva. So why would he be there all alone without a jiva? The whole purpose of the super soul is to accompany the jiva. In the spiritual world, there's no super soul. Because there's no need. Because there's no need for guidance and, you know, remember, you know, prodding the soul to remember to surrender. So the Lord is there as the super soul. Andantarastam, Paramanu. He's inside of the atom. And the jiva is also there. He's so small. Smaller, much smaller than the atom. And they cannot see the atom. So we cannot see the spirit soul. Very shukshma. Sarupo yam. That's the jiva. So, you know, you cannot find the jiva, so how can you kill it? Isn't it? Question? Yes.
Does this mean that there is a jiva in every atom throughout the creation? Or the super soul is there in every atom?
Prabhupada said, yeah, on a morning walk. Yes. So there's, yeah, everything is spirit. Just that there's different levels of consciousness. I mean, we know that the mountains, they were also flying before. There's life in the rock. The jivas are in the rock. So rock is also matter. It's just made of atoms. So what are the jivas doing there? In the plants or in the rock? So actually, the sarvakataha, the jiva is spread everywhere. There's no function for the. We have the statement there that the super soul is present in every atom. So what is it doing there? And so, okay, even if you say that the soul is not there, the super soul is there, so it means that the atom is spirit. That every atom is spiritual. That matter is also spiritual. And then if you think, well, why is he there? What's the purpose of the super soul being in some matter? He's there with the super soul. He's there with the soul. He's there to guide. The only function of the super soul is to guide the jiva soul.
Then there would be no meaning to say 8.4 million species. Everything is ultimately contained in the spirit soul, Then why say that there are this many aquatics, this many? Even stones and they are not counted in the 8.4 million species.
Well, those are species of life. And they reproduce and so forth. And they express themselves, they express their in various ways. But matter does express itself, it's not a species of life. It's like a dormant state. It's a dormant, hidden, crippled state. The most crippled state for the jiva is unconscious. Something else about this? Yeah.
In the previous local we were discussing that if Krishna and Arjuna both are in Maya, what is the meaning of discussion? Generally, Maharaj may say that, like they say, Danda Grahena Mate Nara Narayan Bhove. When I'm holding a Danda, I come to the platform of Brahman. So then one may argue that Krishna is on the platform of Brahman and Arjuna is in Maya. Therefore, he is discussing. Means he is in knowledge, then he is telling. What
to say about that? Krishna is in knowledge, that's true. Arjuna is playing the role of a conditioned person, ignorant person. I don't know, I'd have to meet the person and have him tell me something and then I can argue with him. It's hard for me to offer an argument. I'd have to think about it and meet, have a discussion with the person. Well, there's a difference, there's Krishna's the supreme soul, and Arjuna is, he's Sarup Shakti, he's acting as a jiva, as a Tathashta jiva who's conditioned. So, but even their verse, but Krishna doesn't have a danda, he's also a kshatriya, he's a grihastha. So it's not applicable.
You say that right? Person having a body, and if body is the, body, one can be on the platform of Brahman. I mean to say,
yeah, we say the same thing.
So then, like this Prabhupada says that there is no meaning to tell Bhagavad Gita, so I am not able to understand this line there. Because they can say that Arjuna is in the Maya and here is the Brahman who is giving the knowledge.
Oh, that Krishna is a jiva who is Brahman.
Yes, and so he realizes that he is Brahman and then he is giving knowledge to a Brahman who is in conditioned state. So Bhagavad Gita is valid.
So they are just saying that Krishna is just a jiva who's realized that he's Brahman. But then if we accept that he's realized, then we should accept his statements in the Bhagavad Gita. Right? And he's saying that, that you and I are existing separately, individually, before, now, and in the future, and also these kings. So if Krishna is realized, then we should accept his statements as authority. Then he's not saying that I am the Supreme Brahman and you were part of me. And now we're separated, and later when you realize that you're me, that we will merge together again.
I was mainly confused how individuality is stressed here. It is like, even if one can say that previously I was existing, you are existing, and in future we'll be existing. So this sentence is just we can make, but how individuality is so much stressed on that. That actually, yes, Arjuna is there as Arjuna because Brahman is existing only eternally, like that. So, I was not able to figure out the individuality on this part. Eternity is
very easily understood that the individuality aspect not very clearly seen.
Well, he says aham, tvam, and them, he may.
That time also figure that Brahman is there, Brahman is existing, Brahman is covered, that time also, now it's uncovered. For me,
but then that's the same argument Prabhupada gives in the commentaries. The Mayavadis say that this individuality is conventional, dealing only with the body. That's what you're just saying. So, but Krishna just condemned the bodily conception in verse 11. He's saying that if you're on the bodily conception, then you're not learning. So if you're saying that the individuality is only the body, right, then it means that Krishna is contradicting himself. He's changing gears. Then it's not in context with the text. It doesn't follow the flow of the statement. Krishna already condemned that idea. So now in the next verse, why would he just say, we're only individuals now? Prabhupada already dealt with that in the commentary.
This was the Hero's Methane. Prabhupada explains in the end the theory of reflection.
What's that?
Can you explain that, the theory of reflection?
Oh, yeah.
Like the
sun, well,
the sky and the sun and moon, it's reflection of water.
It's Mayavadi philosophy, it's Pratibimbavad. There's different kinds of Mayavadi philosophy. There's Vivarta and Pratibimba, mainly these two. One is illusion, the other one is reflection. So this one, he's describing the Mayavadi philosophy of reflection. Where is that? Oh, the theory of reflection can be applied to the Supersoul, right? Because the Supersoul is reflected in all living beings, just like the moon or the sun reflected in different pots. But you can't say that with the spirit soul. And let's see. Which is present in each individual body is known as Paramatma. He is different from the individual living entity. When the sky is reflected in water, the reflections represent both the sun and moon and the stars. The stars can be compared to the living entities and the sun or moon to the Lord. The individual fragmental soul is represented by Arjuna, and the supreme soul is the personality of Godhead. They're not on the same level. So Krishna he's reflected in the pots, in all beings. But the jiva is not in every single body. You can't say that with the jiva. The jiva is aware only of his own local situation. But the Supersoul is aware of everyone's situation. So therefore the Pratibimba, in other words, they're trying to use that same reflection theory with the jiva, but it's only true with the spirit, Supreme Spirit. Something else about that?
Prabhupada is quoting this as Mayavada philosophy, or?
Yes. Yeah, that's Mayavada philosophy. He says in the beginning, the Mayavada theory of oneness cannot be entertained on the ground of the spirit. The jiva cannot be cut into pieces as a fragmental portion. Such cutting into different individual souls would make the Supreme cleavable or changeable against the principle of the Supreme Souls being unchangeable. As confirmed in the Gita, the fragmental portions of the Supreme exist eternally and they are called kshara. That is, they have a tendency to fall down. These fragmental portions are eternally so, and even after liberation, the individual soul remains so, fragmental. But once liberated, he lives an eternal life in bliss and knowledge with the Lord. The theory of reflection can be applied to the Supersoul, who is present in each and every body. He is different from the individual living entity. Yeah, that's Mayavad, Pratibimbavad. Jiva is not so transcendental that he can appear in all bodies simultaneously like the Supreme. Because they see that the spirit soul is just like cleavable part of Brahman, that it's just reflected in every body, and then when liberated, springs back to his original Supreme Brahman merging back into the Brahman. Now we're just all reflected parts of the Brahman. Yeah? So anyway, Mayavadi philosophy is pretty strange. Because if one gets liberated, then if we're all one, then why doesn't everyone else just become liberated? And there's so many other arguments you can say. Yeah, something else. It's 12:00. What verse are we on now? 17. Okay. Do a few more. Avinashi tutadvidhi yena sarvam idam tatam vinasham abhayasyasya nakaschakam arhati. That which pervades the entire body, you should know to be indestructible. No one is able to destroy that imperishable soul. 18. Antavanta ime deha nitya shokta sharirana anashino prameyasya tasmat yudasvama. So the previous verse described the spirit soul, and now this verse is describing how the material body is destructible. The material body of the indestructible, immeasurable, and eternal living entity is sure to come to an end. Therefore, fight, O descendant Bhart. So the soul is eternal and the body is destructible. It has to die sooner or later.
Ya enam bitti hantaram yaschainam manyate hatam ubhau talna vijanito nayam hanti lahanyate.
Neither he who thinks the living entity the slayer, nor he who thinks it slain is in knowledge, for the self slays not, nor is slain. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakura says, the self is neither the subject nor the object of the act of killing. That's the meaning of this verse. Because sometimes devotees wonder what exactly is he, Krishna, trying to say here. In other words, you cannot be killed and you cannot kill anyone. So you're not the subject or object of killing. Because it's not impossible to kill the soul, basically. So Krishna is telling Arjuna that one who thinks that he is killing, one who thinks that killing is happening or going on doesn't actually know the truth. Those who criticize you for killing Bhishma are less intelligent. And therefore, why should you worry about what less intelligent people think? Okay, next verse.
Na jayate mriyate va kadachin nayam bhutva bhavita va na bhuyah ajo nitya shashvato yam parano na hanyate hanyamane sharire.
For the soul, there is neither birth nor death at any time. He has not come into being, does not come into being, and will not come into being. He is unborn, eternal, ever-existing and primeval. He is not slain when the body is slain. Again, the same point, a very famous verse. Let's go read the next verse.
Veda vinashinam nityam ya enam ajamavyayam katam sa purusha partha kam ghata yati hantikam.
O Partha, how can a person who knows that the soul is indestructible, eternal, unborn, and immutable kill anyone or cause anyone to kill? Prabhupada comments, everything has its proper utility, and a man who is situated in complete knowledge knows how and where to apply a thing for its proper utility. Similarly, violence also has its utility, and how to apply violence rests with the person in knowledge. Although the justice of the peace awards capital punishment to a person condemned for murder, the justice of the peace cannot be blamed, because he orders violence to another person according to the codes of justice. In Manu Samhita, the law book for mankind, it is supported that a murderer should be condemned to death so that in his next life he will not have to suffer for the great sin he has committed. Therefore, the king's punishment of hanging a murderer is actually beneficial for the murderer. Similarly, when Krishna orders fighting, it must be concluded that violence is for supreme justice and that Arjuna should follow the instruction, knowing well that such violence committed in the act of fighting for Krishna is not violence at all, because at any rate the man, or rather the soul, cannot be killed. So, for the administration of justice, so-called violence is permitted. A surgical operation is not meant to kill the patient, but to cure him. Therefore, the fighting to be executed by Arjuna at the instruction of Krishna with full knowledge is with full knowledge, so there is no possibility of sinful reaction. So this is like a doctor using a scalpel in the hospital. Krishna is cutting away, ordering Arjuna to become that instrument, actually. But we know that that kind of cutting is not violence, it's not ignorance, it's for the benefit of the patient. So although there's some killing going on, but actually it's for the benefit of those persons who are inimical to the Lord and who are sinful and selfish, like Duryodhana. He deserves to be killed, and he should be killed, and that's right. Because sometimes people get very upset about what kind of God do you have. You know, he's killing people and he created this war and so on and so forth. But if you look at the circumstances, you see that the Kauravas, they more than deserved to be killed. And they should be killed for their activities. And not only that, that Krishna and the Pandavas, they tolerated so many injustices for such a long time. And they still tried to make peace and a bargain with the Kauravas, but they were adamant and said no. The Kauravas tried to kill them so many times. And besides, Krishna is the Supreme Lord who can give life. He's the one who gives life in the beginning of creation, and it is his right to take it away when he feels fit. And anyway, every day millions of people are being born on the earth, and every day millions of people are dying. So God is the one who's giving the life, and he's taking it away. He decides. So he's decided now these people should die, and of course new people will be born. So this, you know, it's just a change of dress, and Krishna is the one who's the director of that, to decide at what point who should die now. And that is all according to the person's karma and his desires. So Krishna is not immoral. He's not an immoral God or unethical God or a cruel God. He is quite merciful and kind and humble. And he's like coming to beg Duryodhana and Dhritarashtra, please, let's not have this war. And Krishna sent all of his agents like Vyas, Maitreya and Vidura and this one and that one to convince Dhritarashtra not to fight. But because of their Duryodhana and Dhritarashtra were so attached to enjoying and to having their own kingdom and getting rid of the Pandavas, they were envious of the Pandavas. So there's nothing immoral in what's going on in Krishna's actions. Okay, next verse. Vasam kshi jirnani yatha vihaya lavani grinanti naro parani tatha sharirani vihaya jirnani anyani samyati namani dehi. As a person puts on new garments, giving up the old ones, the soul similarly accepts new material bodies, giving up the old and useless ones. So Arjuna may think that, all right, granting that the soul doesn't die, still the bodies of Bhishma and others are going to be destroyed in the battle. That is wrong because it will deprive them of the happiness they will derive from their own bodies. And Arjuna doesn't want to be the cause of their changing bodies. So Krishna is just minimizing the whole thing, but he's telling the absolute truth is that those bodies are just like garments. And no one laments when you change your clothes at the end of the day. So similarly, no one should lament, especially you, Arjuna, that Bhishma and Drona and the other relatives will change their bodies. Prabhupada comments at the end of his purport, Arjuna is advised herewith by the Lord not to lament for the bodily change of his old grandfather and his teacher. He should rather be happy to kill their bodies in the righteous fight so that they may be cleansed at once of all reactions from various bodily activities. One who lays down his life on the sacrificial altar or in the proper battlefield is at once cleansed of bodily reactions and promoted to a higher status of life. So there was no cause for Arjuna's lamentation. Krishna is using different analogies and different angles of saying the same thing to really drill in this point to Arjuna so that he fully gets the picture and is enlightened. Nainam chintati shastrani nainam dahati pavaraha na chayanam kledayantyapo na shoshayati marata. The soul can never be cut to pieces by any weapon, nor burned by fire, nor moistened by water, nor withered by the wind. So, Krishna is telling that the soul cannot be cut to pieces by any weapon, Arjuna, that you have in your chariot, by any of your sharp arrows or by your sword. You cannot cut the soul. And the soul cannot burn by fire, like your agniastra. The various astras that Arjuna has. He has a fire astra, he has a water astra. So the soul cannot be killed by your fire astra. Your soul cannot be killed by the water astra that you have. Or by the wind astra, the vayu astra. None of these weapons that you have, Arjuna, can kill the soul. So don't worry about Bhishma and Drona. That's his idea. So, and Arjuna says, but when there's a burning house, harms the living entities who are inside of the house. So won't the soul be harmed by the harming of the body? And then Krishna says, no harm will come to the soul, even though the body is destroyed. No harm can come to the soul. Then he speaks this verse.
Anyone who lays down his life the sacrificial
altar, was there in
the
purport? Yeah.
So that refers to animal sacrifice or
previous verse
last
time? That can refer to animal
sacrifice too. No, but who gives up his life on a sacrificial altar? Why does Prabhupada give their preference?
Well, this is a sacrificial altar, this is the Kshatriya. Because the Kshatriyas are laying down their lives in the battlefield. The battlefield is the arena. Especially in this case, it's Dharma Kshetra. So it's like a sacrificial altar. It's not different. So here, Prabhupada's referring to the soldiers laying down their lives on the battlefield. But it's the same. The animal is not conscientiously doing that, but he also gets a new body and is elevated. So similarly, the warriors, they get elevation being killed on the battlefield. And they know that. And besides, they like fighting. It gives them some excitement, you know. They're not afraid to die, actually. And they know that this is like a sacrificial. It's their religions. It's like their church going to the battlefield. It's like going to the temple. Like we lay down our bodies doing dandavas, they lay down their body on the battlefield. And, you know, once and for all, dandavas, you know, they go up. mainly, you know, they go to Swarga. And that's, they're happy to do that. That's the general idea, you know, in Mahabharata and in Karmakanda. It's a low level of religion, but still it's like a sacrifice. Because they're getting elevation.
Yesterday, in chapter 144, Prabhupada said that one who is devoted to spiritual culture, or one who lays down his life in battlefield, he goes to the sun globe. Yeah. So, that reference to Brahma Jyoti, one is...
No, the sun planet.
One who is absolutely 100% devoted to spiritual culture, why will he go to sun planet? Will he go to...
Well, I believe that was a commentary by Vishwanath Chakravarti, that the person, he's talking about, again, about the Kshatriyas on the battlefield. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur also mentioned the sannyasis who are yogis, and they give up their bodies. They go to the sun planet. At least some kinds of yogis, or some kinds of sannyasis. And... So it's not for the devotee. The devotee doesn't go to the sun planet. It's just for a religious person, like in Karmakanda. The sun is considered a heavenly planet, higher planet. That's the context of that statement.
Is this applicable to the today's wars also? The people are fighting on the middle war.
The principle of what, fighting in the battlefield, is it the same at, for what battle, what, in Iraq?
Iraq and America.
Well, I would say on one level, yes, because if some person is, I mean, the government is crooked, that's the true, and, you know, what can we do about that? But the innocent soldiers who, because of being American citizens or Iraqi citizens, they join their civil services or their, you know, the army, then, and they are sent, and they're, you know, to fight on the battlefield, and they're killed. They're actually doing their swadharma in Varnashram as a soldier, as a kshatriya. And so they get elevation. Because they're performing, it's their swadharma. The government leaders, they suffer because of the various karmas involved with, you know, the very fact that America is interested only in the oil and you know, like that. That's economic war. But the innocent soldiers may not fully understand the depths of the depravity of their own government. You know, and so they may still feel duty bound, and so they go to war and they're killed. So they will go to some higher planet. They won't go back to Godhead, but they'll go to some higher material planet. Yeah. I mean, even that murderer who is killed by the state goes to heaven, goes to Swarga. So what to speak of the soldier who is killed on the battlefield? He also gets elevated. Because he's freed from his sins, because he's giving his life. The murderer who's killed by the state is freed from all the sins, from all of his sins. So when he's freed from sins, then he goes up. Chandralok, Suryalok, Indralok, whatever, somewhere higher. In Swarga, region of Swarga. So then, you know, what to speak of the soldiers? Some other point?
Now that we hear on Shloka, it says the blind following the blind goes into the ditch like that. Mm. So here, though the leaders are blind, then the followers are also following the blind people.
That's also true. But That's not referring to that particular kind of circumstance. It's like a general statement. It's an analogy, actually. It's someone's blind and you follow him and he falls into the ditch, then you will also fall into the ditch. So there's some Dharma is not so easy, you know, there's different circumstances. You can take different statements, but you have to understand the context of how to apply the statements. Soldiers, they won't go back to Godhead, but if they're killed, then they'll attain some higher state because they're performing their duty for their country.
Only they're not performing as a kshatriya. First of all, it's not a dharma yudha. No way dharma is a kudicha. Either the people who are doing it or for the country who is performing some dharma. Secondly, the people who are doing that, so we don't know that they are really doing as duty because they may not get any other profession to do, so okay, let's go for a time. They may be, they are not kshatriya after all. So how can they get eligible to be kshatriya?
Well, they're not all of them are kshatriyas, but they're still performing what they consider their occupational duty.
Some may be just drafted.
Huh?
Some may be just forced.
Yeah, but I mean, not everyone's forced to go into the army.
They're in the army themselves. Go for to be 3 years in the army. There is a kind of force. Huh?
To be elevated, you have to perform some dharma. I mean, something from the Vedas, from Vedic activities to perform, in relation to God, to be elevated. Otherwise, what is it that elevates you? Some punya, some vidya.
Well, obviously, each in every case, there's going to be some different blend because there's anishtam, mishram, mishram cha. There's different kinds of karma, and sometimes the bad karma will take hold. Sometimes the good karma. And sometimes there will be a mixture. So. Yeah, although there's no dharma yuddha, that's true. And the persons are not, you know, at least a lot of them may not be kshatriyas, but some of them are, they have a martial spirit. And so every man has to do some kind of work. And if they're performing their occupational duty because of the country, that is kind of higher dharma. So they're sacrificing their life for the country. That is a kind of, you know, there's some elevation for them to do that.
But they are doing attached to the country, not as a duty. They're attached to the country. It's my country, so I'm fighting. Not that, I mean, situation is different.
Well, it depends on the person's consciousness, but in general, there's some sacrifice. Can we say that there's a sacrifice? I mean, they know that they can be killed. There's some sacrifice. Then the elevation may not be very much, but there is some elevation. And as I said, if a murderer, if he's killed by the state, if he can attain heaven, then what about the soldier who's killed in the course of his performing his duty as a soldier for the country? If the murderer himself, who's sinful, he's getting elevated to heaven, then what to speak of the soldier? You have to consider that point. They get some, there's some sacrifice and there's some duty being performed, and they're giving their life. That's nothing. You can't say that's nothing. They're giving their life. That's a sacrifice. So there's something. There's some kind of purification going on. Some kind of elevation happens because of that.
A person committing suicide is also sacrificing his body, he said. Yeah, but then he becomes a ghost. So that's different. Body.
That's a different situation, though.
We really don't know. We are doing as a duty. We are assuming this tradition.
Anyway, I have my argument or my stand. I don't see any argument that you're giving which is counteracting my point that you're saying. We see that if someone commits suicide, that it's different. There's no duty, there's no sacrifice, it's just frustration. He's, you know, God gives him a body, he's killing it himself. And therefore, in the next life, he doesn't get a gross body. Out of, you know, fear and neuroses, and it's a whole different situation. You know?
Yeah. So just like in case of India-Pakistan war, that Sanyasi gave the answer like, unknowingly they are protecting the saintly persons, temples and godly people. So unknowingly they are protecting those kind of citizens. So they get in that way some kind of sacrifice and some elevation.
That's also there. But even if the country has no saintly person like America, well, there must be a few there. So maybe, you know, at least in our movement there are some. In ISKCON there are some. But even if there weren't any saintly person, still there's giving the life for the country, that's some sacrifice that's there. I just, you know, I mean, okay, Gorasundara Prabhu, you may not agree, and you may maintain your idea. That's okay. I'm not saying that you have to just accept what I say. I'm the absolute truth, or the, you know. But at least you should try to understand the the truth of what I'm saying, instead of just trying to immediately see that something wrong with it. So if I say something, then you should try to at least for some time consider the truth that's there. And even though you may have a different opinion, because otherwise there's no benefit in me, you know, teaching. At least you should consider that.
I have a point to support the statement that you are making this night. Varnashma acharavat purushena parakrama. I was sitting in Chaitanya Charitamrita conversation between Ramananda Raya and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Mm. That is, it says that that for a husband it is giving protection to his wife and parents and performing the family duty.
Mm-hmm.
That itself is considered a pratham of karma. And similarly, higher than that, if one is giving his body for his nation, it may be on a material platform, material dharma, but there is also considered dharma.
Uh-huh.
Like the higher duty. So he leaves home for the sake of the nation, he may either give up his life or he may work hard to protect the country. That's considered a higher dharma. And then in this way, dharma goes higher and higher.
Yeah.
Then one comes to the atma soul, then he gives his kaya, vacha, manasa, you know, body, mind and words for the Supreme Lord. So Chakra is also coming in Varna Ashrama. So naturally the act of Chakra is also under the platform of dharma.
Even if a person is not a Kshatriya, if he's just a soldier somehow, he's performing a material duty. Not real full dharma in the full sense of the term, but then his result isn't the same, you know, as a Vedic Kshatriya. But he gets some elevation. He comes.
But then today's Kshatriyas can be compared with the Brahma Kshatriyas. Two things. One thing is, at that time the Kshatriyas consider fighting as their duty. Today, just because they don't get any other job, they take a job like that.
Yeah.
And even at the national level, I have some friends in the military, the authorities also, if they say that I am joining the job for patriotic reasons,
authorities reject such candidates. Authorities don't encourage that.
For patriotic reasons?
Yeah, if somebody
really
says that, because in the, such people, they see that they have a tendency of not being disciplined. It's about the cause of my nation, I will go and do what I want. Okay, so they feel that...
Well, it's not very good.
No, what they say is that they encourage people who just come there because there are good facilities and there is a good job and good environment.
Oh.
And there is a risk of losing one's life. But if somebody comes out of patriotic sentiment, they feel that such sentiments overpower the discipline.
Yeah, well, they probably see that it's that the sentiments are temporary and that people are more steady when they're hooked up to the paycheck and the material benefits, you know, more inspiring on a long-term basis. So,
yeah. You know. So my question,
so that's probably true, but...
So my question was, somebody might take up a job in a military and somebody might take up a job in a hazardous chemical plant.
Yeah.
And both might lose their life. So without Christian consciousness, how will either make any difference? Whether one is lying on the battlefield or one is just burned up because of a chemical explosion?
Well, if the person was going to the, you know, the chemical factory and every day people were dying, you know what I mean? It was like part of the job. Then, and it was, you know, for the benefit of the people to bring them the chemicals that they need to live and so forth, you know. Then the same principle would hold true. But if there's just some accident in the factory, it's not the same. But then the soldier, when he goes on the battlefield, he knows that, you know, this is it. And he chooses that, you know, to go. He may not have the best motive, but neither does the, you know, the, what is the motive of the murderer who gets killed by the state? At least you should see it like that, that he's being killed by the state because this, you know, because the state is engaging him as a soldier. So at least you should accept that he's on the same level as a murderer who's being killed by the state. And that person's elevated. He's freed from his karma. And so his soul rises up, whether it goes to Chandralok or Suryalok or Indralok or whatever, but it goes up to some higher planet. Of course, he'll just enjoy there and then come back down again and whatever. But there's some material elevation of the soul. That's my only point.
But does that not be a murderer? Just being like being killed, he will only be cleansed of the reaction or having murdered someone else. But prior to that, whatever karmic history he has, that will determine whether he will go to heaven or not. Just by being killed, it won't, will it be that all the sins that he has committed throughout his life will be cleansed?
Maybe not all, but enough of them that he rises up. Everybody, I mean, karma is not such a, you know, black and white thing. It's not so easy to determine. But I've seen statements that, and my understanding is that he gets purified for more than just the sin of killing that person. Because he's being killed is not a, you know, I mean, try it. Getting killed is not a simple, easy thing. And when, you know, when the person is executed by the state or on the battlefield, it's the same. So at least we should give the soldiers that much benefit of the doubt. I'm not saying they're great religious kshatriyas and, you know, like Arjuna, but I'm just saying that they get purified because they're getting killed, and that's purifying. When someone's killed, they're free from the karmas. A lot of them, or enough of them, that they go up to some higher planet.
This statement is a purport of Prabhupada, or?
I can try to find some, yeah.
Because, yeah. You know, if it's taken out of context, like suppose Saddam Hussein, the American army kills him. So he's got killed by the American government. He has committed so much murder before that. Will he just by that be killed by the American army? Will he go by?
I don't know about Saddam Hussein.
No, my point is, if you're talking about murder, then I'm sorry.
If Afghanistan decides that he's murdered people and then they incarcerate him and then they throw him on the electric chair or whatever they do in Afghanistan, they hang him, then he gets purified from his sins from killing those people. And then he gets elevated. There's some elevation. Then he comes down again and he commits sins again and then he may go to hell. You know, it's not the end of the story. The soul's going up and down in the material realm. At least think about what I'm saying. That's all I'm concerned. You don't have to... It's not that I'm, you know, adamant to convince all of you this is my point. And to me, if whether you accept it or not, it doesn't matter to me. But that's how I see it. And from what I've studied for 28 years and from, you know, what I know of Shastra, and this is my understanding. We have to stop now. It's chapati time. You may sacrifice yourself on the chapati altar and go to chapati loka, you know, and come back down as a samosa again. But you must do your duty. So we have to stop now. Hare Krishna. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.